This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about the National Defense Authorization Act, referred to as NDAA. It permits indefinite detention of certain persons. We're also going to be talking about some other civil rights issues. My guests are Stanley Friedman, criminal law certified specialist who's in Los Angeles. He's a former chair of the Criminal Law Advisory Commission of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. John Eisenberg, an appellate law certified specialist in Oakland. John has been the appellate lawyer for the past 6 years in a litigation involving Al Haramain Islamic Foundation versus Obama, which successfully challenged the legality of President Bush's warrantless electronic surveillance program, and it's now on appeal to the Ninth Circuit, and I think the Ninth Circuit panel will be hearing it. Is it on June 1st?
June 1st.
June 1st of this year. My third guest is Susan Scott. Susan is co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild International Committee. And for those of you who are listening to us live, I will be giving you our local phone number that you can call in wherever you are in the state of California. You can call in during the second half hour. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California, which certifies the following fields of law: appellate law, bankruptcy law, criminal law, estate planning, trust and probate law, family law, franchise and distribution law, immigration and nationality law, taxation law, workers' compensation law, legal malpractice law, and admiralty and maritime law. Additional funding is provided by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Well, Susan and John and Stan, thank you very much for joining us. Susan, would you do this? The National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, the main... When this program, where this topic was suggested to me, it was because of the very great concern a lot of people have about indefinite detention. Could you take a couple of minutes and kind of summarize for us the NDAA and what you feel you'd like to cover on tonight's program?
I will. I wanted to give you an idea of why I'm interested in it in the first place. I think probably most people are, but the National Defense Authorization Act is authorizes every year. There's a new National Defense Authorization Act that authorizes expenditures for the Defense Department, and it has a lot of provisions. But this year it had two very, very scary provisions, most people would say, Sections 1021 and 1022. These are provisions that we heard about that were so controversial towards the end of the year. Obama finally signed it on the 31st, on New Year's Eve. The two provisions that we're so concerned about are Section 1021, which allows for indefinite detention without trial of two different groups of people. One is those who planned or were otherwise involved in 9/11. Two is any person who is part of or substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners, including any person who has committed a belligerent act or who has directly supported such hostilities in aid of such enemy forces. So if you don't fit into one of those categories, but the government thinks you do, and they send you off to indefinite detention without trial, how do you prove that you are not an associated force? That's a concern that we have. The second section that's very upsetting is the Section 1022, which provides that these certain people captured in the course of these hostilities must be held in military custody. That section explicitly exempts U.S. citizens. The first section does apply to U.S. citizens. But the second section exempts U.S. citizens, which is why Obama said that he signed it. But the first section does apply to U.S. citizens.
And I might add...
Go ahead, John, please. Yeah,
I might emphasize that in Section 1021, the authorization is for indefinite military detention of, among other things, anyone who substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban or associated forces. And that's where there's great ambiguity. What does it mean to substantially support Al-Qaeda? What are associated forces? That could be construed very broadly to include perhaps someone like me who has represented an Islamic charity in Oregon suing the Bush and subsequently Obama administration for warrantless wiretapping and doing so successfully. One might argue that I have substantially supported accused terrorists within the meaning of the NDAA, and I'm therefore at risk of indefinite military detention.
And speaking of lawyers who are potentially subject to this, my whole organization is potentially subject to this, the National Lawyers Guild, which...
The whole group. How many lawyers?
There's 3,500 lawyers
that
around
really,
the country.
That would make an impression.
Yeah.
That would really fill up Guantanamo Bay.
Well, speaking of Guantanamo Bay, the NDAA has a provision that Guantanamo Bay cannot be closed. Isn't that correct?
Yes. It effectively keeps it open and prevents transfer of detainees to the United States for the next year.
And President Obama, very early in, even before he was elected president, stated that he would look to close, or maybe it was in the very early part of his presidency, look to close Guantanamo in a relatively short period of time. So he's changed his position.
Well, his campaign promise was to close it within a year.
Yeah.
He hasn't done that. And in fact, he signed the NDAA that prevents him from doing it.
So. I just got a note here from one of the listeners, and it's this. This is the question. And certainly, Stan, if you're still there, aren't you, Stan?
I'm with you.
We haven't lost you. Okay, you're down in L.A. You're not lost in L.A., are you? I'm glad to hear that.
Yes.
Here's a question that was brought into the studio to me from one of the listeners, and it goes like this. Can't we take comfort in the fact that President Obama issued a signing statement that he would not invoke these indefinite detention provisions? Number one, is this correct? Did he actually sign? Did he issue a signing statement saying that or not?
He has promised not to detain citizens indefinitely. He said, here's a quote, "It would break with our most important traditions and values as a nation," unquote, to do so. Now, I do take some comfort that at least through the end of this year, this president will not make any effort to detain me. But he signed the bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's law now, and... what's to prevent the next president...
Assuming it's not President Obama.
Well, it might be him for the next 4 years, but it certainly will not be him after 2016.
Okay. Right.
And he's not obligated even by his own signing statement.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
It's a press release.
It's a press release. I do have confidence that he will not move, barring any real big change in foreign policy, to detain citizens indefinitely without trial. But he has set a precedent. He has signed into law a bill that would seem to permit it. And that is a matter of great concern.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Stan?
It sets a dangerous precedent. I mean, to the extent that a politician issues a statement justifying reason that he's signing a law is, I think, entirely irrelevant. It's the precedent that's set. To the extent that President Obama is the president, he's free to ignore his own comments. We see that oftentimes with politicians. So I think it's in an election year, he's likely to be more circumspect if he were to be reelected. He could choose to ignore his own words. And to the extent that there's another president, that president obviously can use the precedent of what was signed into law on December 31st, 2011.
You know, one of the things I'm finding, Joanne, the reception here with Stan is not that good. Can you detect that? I'm wondering if we need to hang up on Stan and you call him again. It sounds okay to you? Okay, all right. I hear a little kind of muffling. What I want to do at this point is take a very brief break. for just a few seconds, and then we'll be right back. All right, it is our Call a Lawyer night. We've got a number of attorneys here who want to talk with you, help you if you have a legal problem, everywhere from workers' compensation, criminal law, family law, legal malpractice law, landlord-tenant law, tax law, real estate, and tomorrow, by the way, Leon Baer, who's a certified specialist in bankruptcy law, will be available to talk with you, and I will tell you his 800 number a little bit later in the program. So these people are here. If you want to speak to the first six people who I mentioned, the number is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. At about 7:27, I will give you our phone number so you can call us on the air here. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program on the National Defense Authorization Act. We're also going to be talking about some other civil rights issues and concerns. My guests are Susan Scott, co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild International Committee, Stanley Friedman, criminal law certified specialist in Los Angeles, former chair of the Criminal Law Advisory Commission of the Board of Legal Specialization, and my third guest is John Eisenberg, appellate law certified specialist in Oakland. And John is concerned that at some point, because he's been representing an organization called Al Haramain Islamic Foundation, he may find himself in unlimited detention.
Well, the NDAA suggests that could happen.
I hope not.
I'd like to get back to the signing statement.
Please, if you would.
President Obama did say that indefinite military detention without trial is contrary to the nation's values. What he didn't say is that it's illegal.
Mm.
That's what I wish he had said. Mm. This is illegal. We do not do this to our own citizens.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what's missing from this president.
Let me throw out something to you, and correct me if I'm wrong on this. In Egypt, there are Americans who are being detained, are they not, by the Egyptian government,
yes,
without trial. Is that right? And what are we as a nation, the United States of America, doing, if anything, to try to help these people and trying to get Egypt to give them some justice?
I think they are planning to charge them and try them.
Oh, they are.
They aren't being just thrown
into
a black
hole.
So
it's not indefinite detention. Okay.
It's just they haven't been
gone
to trial yet.
And who are these Americans who are over there who are in detention? Do you know?
Yes.
What have they been doing?
They've been working illegally because Egypt has quite strict rules about outside funding of NGOs in the country. And
NGOs, what's that
national,
mean?
Non-governmental organizations.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And political organizations. So they've been funded by USAID, which is part of our State Department, through the National Endowment for Democracy, I think. One of them works for the International Republican Institute, and the other is the Democrat equivalent of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they use U.S. funds from USAID mostly to advise local groups in Egypt on democracy issues. And they do, this is actually happens all over the world. There's these National Endowment for Democracy groups go all over the world. And in some places they're illegal and in some places they aren't. And in Egypt they're illegal. So they've been trying to get a permit for years there and not able to do it. And now this government, now that Mubarak is out, the current government has decided to crack down on them.
We have the same laws in the United States. We require some lobbying for a foreign government. I mean, we had a president of the United States whose brother, Billy Carter, was a foreign agent for the government of Libya, but he was required to register. I think the concern in Egypt is that these people, for years under the Mubarak administration, were left in limbo and were not permitted to register, but it de facto operated legally within the country. And then suddenly there's a change in the administration in Egypt, and now people who were otherwise acting legally or de facto legally are now not being permitted to leave the country, and unless they're sitting in the American embassy, are going to be tried or maybe actually tried in absentia.
Well, now, if they are in the American embassy, are they protected because they are within the walls of the American embassy so that the Egyptian government can't just come in and take them out and put them in jail, or what? They are.
Right.
Susan, you're saying they are protected.
They're protected from detention by the government, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're on American soil, but mm-hmm. they could be a prisoner in the embassy. I mean, for example, you know, years ago, I think there was a North Korean who was wanted by the New York Police Department. And the police department indicated, I think it was for a sexual offense, and the department indicated if and when he left the embassy, you know, he was going to be arrested.
Yeah.
And as a result, he resided in the embassy for years.
Mm.
I don't recall the end of that case, but I think that's what would happen there. Unless the Egyptian people stormed the American embassy like they stormed the Israeli embassy,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think the Americans would be safe, but imprisoned at the American embassy.
Now, here's an irony about the American detainees in Egypt. They will go to trial, perhaps in absentia, perhaps they'll be able to attend their trials. One might question the fairness of those trials, but they will go to trial.
Are they entitled to a lawyer over there?
That I do not know.
Probably.
I imagine
so. I seriously doubt if they'll go to trial. Mm-hmm. I think they'll work something out and just send them home.
But, do you?
But the irony is this. There are detainees in Guantanamo Bay who will not go to trial, who will be held indefinitely without trial, about 46 of them. There are about 89 who have been cleared for release from Guantanamo Bay, but they're not being released anyway. Mm-hmm. We are actually holding people in Guantanamo Bay not only without trial, but also who have been cleared for release, and they are being detained indefinitely.
How are they under what provision are they being detained? If they have been cleared for release, why are they not being released?
Well, I think some of the difficulty is where to release them.
Oh, I see.
Some of them are from Yemen. Some of them are Uyghurs from China.
Then some of this, then, is for their own protection, I presume.
Well, the NDAA prohibits their transfer to the United States.
Oh,
so
I see.
They can't be released in the U.S. because the NDAA prohibits it.
I see.
So we're in the odd position of holding innocent people.
Admittedly innocent people.
Admittedly innocent people, which is something that is not even happening in Egypt, at least not yet.
So there are 171 detainees in Guantanamo Bay, 89 of whom have been cleared for release but will not be released.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
And altogether, there were 779 people that went through Guantanamo. So a lot have been released, but after years and years and years of languishing in that hellhole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as a
92% of those people were found to never have been fighters, al-Qaeda fighters, and 86% were handed over pursuant to a bounty offer.
What
to
is
the
it?
US.
Okay, there were bounty hunters hunting, and
the US
these people made money,
an offer. Uh-huh.
Made punnies on money on getting these people and dragging them in.
Yes,
giving them to Americans to the American forces that then sent them to Guantanamo.
Oh wow, there's a case, a recent U.S. Supreme Court case that came down in 2010, Holder. What is that case, Susan, and how does that fit in terms of what we're talking about tonight?
This is a really shocking case. It was brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, most of whose members are part of the National Lawyers Guild. They were representing a organization called the Humanitarian Law Project, which was working with a designated by the U.S. State Department terrorist organization in Turkey, the Kurdish People's Party, the Kurdish Workers' Party, PKK. They were working with them to try to teach them nonviolent, non-terrorist ways to get their grievances met, because they do have grievances. They're not allowed to use their language. There's lots of cultural and oppression of the Kurdish people in Turkey. So they were working with these people and trying to teach them how to go to the UN, to the Human Rights Council, how to get their grievances met in a nonviolent way. And it occurred to the lawyers that this might be something that could be called material support in violation of the Patriot Act, and
which is separate from NDAA.
Separate from the NDAA.
Okay.
This is what I think it is important to look at the NDAA in the context of some other things that have been going on lately, like the Patriot Act and this Supreme Court decision. The Center for Constitutional Rights decided, just to be sure, that they would take the case and ask for a declaratory judgment from the court. The organization hadn't been prosecuted, but just asked if they could possibly be prosecuted under this material support provision of the Patriot Act. And the lower courts all said no. They were either for one reason or another, mostly because the language was too vague. Material support, what does that mean? But when it went to the Supreme Court said, yes, there's a First Amendment issue, but it's so important to deal with terrorism that even though there's group is doing something that's protected by the First Amendment, it's not absolutely protected. And so, yes, they could be. And no, it's not vague. And yes, they could be prosecuted under the Patriot Act. And that came out, I think it was July of 2010. And ever since then, a lot of people have been very nervous. Because if the people who are doing the trying to turn not previously terrorist groups into non-terrorist groups, if they're not safe from these provisions, then who is?
Material support. Those are the key words, whatever right. that means.
And definitely legal assistance is material support.
All right. It is our Call a Lawyer night. I think some of our attorneys are not on the phones. Why don't you give them a call if you have a question in the areas of either workers' comp, criminal law, family law, legal malpractice law, landlord-tenant law, tax law, real estate. The number is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. In just a few minutes, we will be taking some calls on the program, on the air, dealing with civil rights. If you would like to join us, the number is 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program on the National Defense Authorization Act, which, if you've been following us, deals with indefinite detention of certain persons. We're talking about some other civil rights issues. My guests are John Eisenberg, appellate law certified specialist in Oakland. His office is in Oakland. He's been handling a case for 6 years involving an organization called the Al Haramain Islamic Foundation versus Obama. It went through trial in the district court, U.S. District Court, and John won. It's now being it challenges the legality of President Bush's warrantless electronic surveillance program. It's on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. The hearing before a panel of three justices will be on June 1st. My other guests are Susan Scott. She's co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild International Committee. My third guest is down in Los Angeles, Stanley Friedman, criminal law certified specialist in Los Angeles, former chair of the Criminal Law Advisory Commission of the Board of Legal Specialization. Well, let's do this. Stan, I haven't given you enough time to voice some thoughts that you might want to make. And so in the remaining few minutes of the statewide version of the program, are there any other things you'd like to bring up so that we can talk about? And in a few minutes, we'll take some calls from the listeners.
Historically, I just think without the changes that the NDAA brought in at the end of last year, I think the United States government could have well taken care of issues that relate to foreign matters, issues of terrorism, crimes against the United States. I do think it's important to treat crimes against the government and crimes against American citizens as crimes rather than just putting somebody under lock and key indefinitely. To the extent that somebody's caught on the battleground, we have laws that in terms of international conflicts, and I think to the extent that somebody is a POW, for example, he should be treated as a POW and afforded that sort of treatment and have the rights of a POW. To the extent that hostilities end, then a POW is normally repatriated to the country that he or she came from. And I think perhaps the government has done a disservice by having such a significant change in the law in this country.
Here's a question, and I'd appreciate you voicing your thoughts on this. This is from one of the listeners. How does indefinite detention square with habeas corpus protections guaranteed under the Constitution? Is habeas corpus dead?
No.
with respect to NDAA?
It's not dead in the United States or in Guantanamo. The Supreme Court has made it clear that it applies. But habeas corpus is a very limited thing. All habeas corpus is a challenge to the reason for the detention. And the law says that you can detain people if you, you know, if they come under these provisions. So the problem is going to be more, I would think, that if people are picked up here and then sent to countries where habeas corpus maybe won't apply. The Supreme Court hasn't really determined whether habeas corpus can.
You're not talking about American citizens who are sent over to someone. Oh, you're indicating possibly that also.
Could be, you know. But, wow. And Bagram Air Force Base has been, it's kind of, there's some indication that habeas corpus doesn't apply there.
Where is that?
That's in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan. Okay. I know you have something, John.
I'm going to beg to differ just a little bit about the state of habeas corpus in Guantanamo Bay. Theoretically, the writ of habeas corpus is available to the detainees. The U.S. Supreme Court has said so. Mm-hmm. In reality, in practice, right, the way it's played out over the past few years, it is dead, at least in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, where all of those cases have been litigated.
Backed up.
Every single case where habeas has been granted and gone up to the D.C. Circuit has been reversed. As a practical matter, there has not yet been a single instance of habeas relief being granted to these detainees.
What about going up to the Supreme Court?
They haven't taken any of the cases.
They have not. They refused. In other words, they have refused where there has been a appeal or whatever it may be from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeal.
Correct.
The U.S. Supreme Court has refused to take it.
Right. Since the initial decision, Boumediene, which held that the writ of habeas corpus exists. Mm. Since then, they've not taken any more cases, and the writ has been slowly dismantled in Guantanamo Bay.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Stan, about this?
To the extent that somebody's being held for military reasons, I just don't think the writ of habeas corpus is going to be effective. It's a court proceeding, and to the extent that it's permissible to hold somebody for no purpose indefinitely, I don't think the right that somebody has to file a habeas corpus petition in the federal courts is meaningful at all.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly hasn't played out that way.
Well, I think what I'd like to do now is any website that you have, Susan, that you'd like to let the listeners know about to follow what the National Lawyers Guild is doing?
Yeah, the Lawyers Guild's website is www.nlg.org.
NLG.org. Okay.
And the International Committee is nlginternational.org. Well, and there's a good statement that the Lawyers Guild put out a few days before Obama signed the NDAA, a good statement on the various different constitutional and international law provisions that are violated by the NDAA.
So that will be on the
NLGInternational.org.
All right. All right. Unfortunately, our statewide version of the program has come to an end. We will continue live in the Bay Area. We'll continue live on the internet at www.klw.org. It is 729, just about 729, at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. We're doing a program on civil rights issues, particularly focusing initially on the National Defense Authorization Act, which is abbreviated as NDAA. If you have some questions, I invite you to call in, ask a question, make a comment, have a discussion with my guests. The number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. It is also our regular Call a Lawyer night, this being the fourth Wednesday of the month, and I'd like you to know who we have here. For workers' compensation, Alice O'Sullivan, certified specialist in workers' compensation, former chair of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Jeff Hayden, a criminal law certified specialist, he is the chair of the Criminal Law Advisory Commission of the Board of Legal Specialization. Yasmin Mehmet, who is a certified specialist in family law. Peter Fortune, who is a certified specialist in legal malpractice law. He is also the chair of the Legal Malpractice Law Commission of the Board of Legal Specialization. For landlord-tenant law, we have James Coy Driscoll, whose name you may recall since he's usually here at least every 6 weeks or so when we do a landlord-tenant law program on the air. Frank Adam for tax law and real estate, and tomorrow, that is Thursday, February 23rd, from 8:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m., Leon Baer, who's a certified specialist in bankruptcy law, will be looking to talk with you if you have some issues. You're being hounded by creditors. He's happy to talk to you. You might want to jot down his number, 1-800-477-3111. 1-800-477-3111. If you call him and you get a recording, please leave your name and phone number, and he will call you back. Our call a lawyer night this evening off the air is 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. On the air, it's 1-415-841-4134. And for those of you who have tuned in the last few minutes and maybe didn't get the earlier part of the program, let me tell you who's here. And I see a lot of you would like to talk to my guests, so quickly I will tell you who they are. Stanley Friedman, criminal law certified specialist. He is in Los Angeles, a former chair of the Criminal Law Advisory Commission of the Board of Legal Specialization. John Eisenberg, appellate law certified specialist. His office is in Oakland. And Susan Scott, co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild International Committee. And we're going to start with you, Nancy. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes. I'm very disturbed about the passing of this law. And also, it seems from everything I've read and experienced in the last 3 years that Obama is pretty much in lockstep with the Bush administration as far as rendition and taking away more and more of our civil rights. And I think it's extremely disturbing because he's, you know, supposedly liberal in comparison to the monkeys that are running for the GOP. I watched them tonight and talk about crazy scaries. There they are. And as the lawyer said, this is, you know, this law is on the books, and maybe Obama won't do certain things, but there it is. And
did you have a particular point or question that you wanted my guest to respond to?
No, just
you wanted to tell us. Okay, well, Nancy, thank you very much for your call.
Sure. It doesn't go into effect until a week from Saturday, so we're safe for a while.
I'm sorry, what doesn't
the NDAA?
Oh, it does not.
No.
Okay, a week from Saturday.
Yeah.
That's the big black day, huh? Oh, my. Heidi, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, it's Heidi.
I'm sorry, Heidi.
Okay.
Excuse me.
It's all right.
Hey.
I would like to ask any one of your guests or all of them the following question.
Sure.
I'm involved with a group, a couple of groups that are trying to bring public awareness about some of the issues that are confronting all of us in regards to civil rights and other issues. And I wondered what any one of them might feel is the most effective thing to do in terms of making this public so people can be aware and perhaps react.
Susan, if you would.
It's really sort of double-edged sword, because you don't want to scare people and you don't want to chill people's mm-hmm. First Amendment rights. So it's important that people sort of act proactively. And there actually are some provisions in Congress now pending to repeal one section. Most of the concern that people have is about U.S. citizens being mm-hmm. subject to this. Mm-hmm. And I think most of the people from the Guild feel that that's misplaced, that it really it shouldn't matter. Nobody should be subject to
right.
this kind of mm-hmm. treatment. So, all of our local Congress members signed this thing, so we need to tell them we're not happy about it,
mm-hmm.
that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is really important for people not to let it get in the way of their activism.
No, of course not. That would be the last thing I would want. But do you think that a demonstration about this is a good idea or not a good idea?
Sure. I think there was one, actually, on February 3rd, I think. But not, I'm sure there's some actions planned for the day that it goes into effect, March 3rd.
Right, but I was asking specifically if you think those are reasonable things to do or just, you know, political theater.
Well, political theater isn't such a bad idea.
Okay.
I mean, I do think that it's important for people to know about it.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Heidi, thank you. Heidi, thank you very much for calling. This is Your Legal Rights, 1-415-841-4134. Robin, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much for having us, because so many people are so concerned about what's going on. I think my basic question is, isn't the NDAA completely illegal? On what basis could it be considered legal? Like, for example, in the context of the Patriot Act or in times of war, I mean, is there some way to twist it so that legally they're allowed to give up our Bill of Rights and Constitution, which to me is an illegal act? When I called Barbara Boxer's office, for example, the only thing that they told me was that she voted for it, for pay, for soldiers, and for pensions, and they had zero statement to make on why she had voted for the NDAA, which I consider illegal. I get a lot of very liberal emails from that office, and I'm just wondering, where is the disconnect? What is going on? All of us think it's illegal to do. How could they possibly vote for something that is illegal? And if it is, then what do we do about it?
Let me, Robin, then get some comments for you from my guests as to whether or not they feel it is, as you do, completely illegal. Let me start with you, John. What do you think?
Well, one of the reasons why the NDAA got so much support ultimately as passed was because there were some compromises put into that bill. Earlier drafts of it were a lot worse. Ultimately, the most controversial element of the bill was made ambiguous, and that's the issue of indefinite detention of civilians. The bill, as it was finally passed, says it does not, this is a quote, does not affect existing law or authorities relating to the detention of United States citizens, and it does not limit or expand the authority of the president. In effect, the NDAA is saying whatever the law is on indefinite detention of civilians, that's not changed by this bill. The question is,
but I know that there is some concern about the Jose Padilla case before it, such that they say, well, existing law did allow them to detain people, so people are not sure what this means.
Right. Exactly. It's subject to dispute, and that's why the bill ultimately got enough support to pass, and why Obama felt, I'm not sure he ever really did intend to veto it, but because it was watered down somewhat, he had an excuse for not vetoing it.
If this gets to the U.S. Supreme Court at some point, assuming it does, do you think that the justices, the current justices on the Supreme Court, will uphold it or not? Do you have any opinion on that?
Well, they really would not be in a position to declare the bill unconstitutional to the extent it authorizes indefinite detention of civilians, because it actually doesn't. It doesn't take a position either way. It is subject to interpretation as doing so.
Stan, do you have some thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, in terms of why it was passed, I think we live in a world of jingoistic politics where people will vote for things, politicians will vote for things because it sounds good, and the details of it oftentimes get lost. In terms of the legality of it, so far it seems as that it would be.
That it would be what?
So far, I'm not aware of anybody declaring it, for example, unconstitutional.
Yeah, okay.
Right. And I suspect that if it were to go all the way to the Supreme Court, it likely would be decided by Justice Kennedy. You know, it would be.
What do you think he would do? Do you have any prediction?
My best guess is, unless it's enforced, if it permits. It would be an issue as to whether people who are viewed as being combatants are being, to the extent that people are, who are viewed as combatants are being held indefinitely. I don't think he would have a problem with that.
I see.
I think that generally happens during wartime. And at the end of the war, then the people are repatriated. Here, it's a different type of situation because I don't know when the war on terrorism would end, if ever. But in general, I don't think he would have a problem with that. I think he would have a problem with U.S. citizens, let's say Jose Padilla, for example.
Who is it? By the way, we need to let everybody know. Who is Jose Padilla?
American citizen who was detained, I think he was arrested in Chicago, or detained in Chicago, and my understanding is he was held in military detention for quite a while before he was transferred to civilian custody.
So where is he now? Do we know?
He's in prison in Maryland or someplace.
He's been
I think
convicted of something?
Yeah, I think he was convicted.
He was.
Uh-huh.
Not everything he was originally charged with.
But what was he convicted of? Do we know?
He was going to bomb a plane.
Oh, was he? Okay.
I don't remember exactly the details. It wasn't the underwear
serious,
bomber.
That's
it wasn't
a pretty
the shoe.
Serious
oh,
problem. Yeah.
He wasn't necessarily a good guy.
No, not that kind of person.
Let me just add that I have faith personally that if I were prosecuted for substantially supporting terrorism in pursuing the Al-Haramain litigation, that Anthony Kennedy would not approve my indefinite military detention.
I would hope not. I certainly would hope not.
I have some faith there.
Yeah, I do.
But you basically have to wait until they detain you before you can go. You don't have standing until you...
Yeah, don't push it, John. Don't push it, please. All right, a couple of things.
But, well, one other
yeah,
thing.
Go ahead, Susan.
It's definitely in violation of international law, and that's something that our judges
why
don't
do you say
like
that? Why do you say
well,
that?
Well, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights mm-hmm. provides for a right to due process and life and liberty. But that also is much more specific in the International Covenant on Political and Civil Rights, which is one of the very few, 3 out of 9 major human rights covenants that the U.S. has actually signed and ratified. And the irony of this whole timing thing is that the U.S., under the ICCPR, the Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, which this totally violates, every 4 years, I think it is, the U.S. has to submit a report on its obligations and whether it's lived up to its obligations under this treaty. And they just submitted their report on the ICCPR committee is going to be reviewing the United States this year, and so they had to submit their report before the end of the year. They submitted it the day before Obama signed this the NDAA, and there's no mention
no
in
mention
that
of, the NDAA?
Of the
NDAA. Well, that was convenient.
Yes,
that was very convenient. All right, it's your legal rights 1-415-841-4134. A lot of people want to speak to you, and it's also our Call a Lawyer night. We have a number of attorneys here. And that number is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. If you are having, let's say, if your property is underwater and you're facing a foreclosure on your property and you're wondering if bankruptcy will help you or if you're being hounded by creditors, tomorrow, Leon Bayer, Thursday, February 23rd, he's a certified specialist in bankruptcy law. Been incredibly gracious with his time, been doing this now for I think at least 3 years. Usually the Thursday after we do Call a Lawyer night, he'll be available tomorrow from 8:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. The number, if you'd like to jot it down, if you have a question about how you can deal with your creditors, 1-800-477-3111. 1-800-477-3111. If you call and you get a voicemail message, leave your name and phone number. He will call you back. Our Call a Lawyer number tonight is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. For those of you who may have a modest estate, this is changing the subject, so bear with me for a minute. It's very important to have a plan in place to guide loved ones once you pass away. So on March 8th, and I'll announce this again, attorney who is a certified specialist in estate planning, Catherine Ray Wong, will discuss small estates at a noontime lecture at the San Mateo County Law Library, which they do this about every month, Thursday, March 8th at noon to 1 p.m. You can bring your sack lunch and learn what you can do prior to your death to protect your small estate and the advantages it affords loved ones, and that'll be at the San Mateo County Law Library, located at 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City. And again, I will let you know about this next week, certainly, but I wanted you to be aware of it. It's kind of unusual, I think, to have a lecture on small estates, and we will be doing, by the way, with Catherine, I think it's on March 14th, we will be doing a program with her on this program about small estates. So I hope you might join us for that. All right. Monica, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Thank you for this excellent topic. I I'd like to hear what your attorneys have to say or their comments about the killing of Al-Alaqui in Yemen. I believe he's an active terrorist, and I have not shed any tears about his killing. However, how it was done and that it was done concerns me. He's a U.S. citizen, and it seems to me that Obama, I think it was Obama who gave the orders, acted as judge, jury, and executioner and completely denied a U.S. citizen their due process. And so I would like, and although he might have been it might be under war, that it's a different situation. So if you could clarify a little on that.
Okay, let me get some comments for you, Monica. Turn your radio back up if you would. Thank you very much for the question.
Okay,
you want to start, John?
Sure. My initial reaction from the gut when I heard this news was, good, he got rid of a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Then I thought about it.
Who killed him, by the way?
President Obama.
Obama, yeah.
So our forces...
Drone.
Our forces.
He gave assassinated this guy.
By drone.
With a drone, with unmanned, unwomaned...
Who else was killed? Who else was killed? How many other people?
Several others.
Some bystanders. Some innocent, innocent people were killed. But we did take out a bad guy. However, giving it some more thought, consider this. George W. Bush wiretapped people without warrants. He sent them to foreign countries to be tortured without legal process. Obama just kills them.
Mm.
Right. And this case is particularly interesting also because it was announced before the drone hit that he was going to be assassinated, and the Center for Constitutional Rights was approached by his father, who is an American.
Mr. Lockley's father?
They're both American citizens.
Yeah. Okay.
And so the father approached the Center for Constitutional Rights and asked to challenge this declaration, mm-hmm. you know, and this intention that the government had already expressed that they were going to be assassinating him. And in order to represent the father to challenge this planned assassination, the Center for Constitutional Rights had to go to court first to ask permission to represent him so that they then wouldn't be sued for and prosecuted for materially supporting a terrorist. Oh. And they were given that permission, and they went to court. They went to court, and the case was dismissed. Mm. And you know more about that, probably.
Here's the danger in trusting our president to assassinate bad guys who happen to be American citizens. Mm. The danger is that he might get it wrong. Everybody makes mistakes, including the president. Mm-hmm. We have detained a number of people in Guantanamo Bay, admittedly wrongly. If the president may assassinate people outside legal process, there's no check on the human propensity to make mistakes.
Mm. Wow. This is pretty scary.
Maybe John can talk a little bit more about the state secrets provisions that keep, even if you do go to court to try to challenge something that keep the government from shooting your child,
mm-hmm.
you can't get anywhere because of the state secrets privilege.
Well, that's been the big issue in my own particular litigation, the Al-Haramain case, is the government asserts that we may not litigate this case at all because it involves matters that are secret. Mm-hmm. And so we simply should not have access to the courts for redress. Mm-hmm. We eventually fought back those attempts, but it's something that the Bush administration did repeatedly and that the Obama administration has continued to do repeatedly.
Mm-hmm. All right. 1-415-841-4134. You know, this is a program I think you all realize that we probably could have expanded this to 2 hours. Unfortunately, we can't. The call a lawyer number is 1-800-525-9917. Here's a question, another one written down, brought into the studio. How does execution of an American citizen by presidential decree square with suspension of habeas corpus per NDAA?
Well,
It goes hand in hand, does it not?
You know, what good is habeas corpus if you're just going to assassinate someone? Yeah.
Stan, any thoughts from you?
It moots it.
Well, I wonder what process, maybe this is to throw out to the panel, for example, what process should have been used prior to, you know, the assassination of this individual or other individuals? Would you just say that somebody either has to be captured and tried, or as long as he makes it to a foreign shore, you know, he or she would be safe?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. What process should there be?
It would be certainly fair to say that Osama bin Laden was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the forces went into his home. My understanding is that, you know, they didn't try to put handcuffs on him. They just shot him.
You shot him.
Dead, and then equivalent of disposing of his body, you know, in the ocean.
For the record, I must say that I think that happens to have been President Obama's greatest achievement.
Yeah.
But he was not an American citizen, and I know perhaps Susan might argue with me about this a bit, but I think that makes a difference in terms of what the American government can do. Should not be doing.
Yeah. So, in other words, you're saying.
I'm just wondering, for example, even for a U.S. citizen, what process would such a person be afforded? Could you try him in absentia?
Well, that's a good question. We've never before had to grapple with the issue of how do we take out an American citizen abroad? I don't know. Yeah. It's something that'd be worth a few congressional hearings
Susan, what thought do you have on this? What should they have done with Lockley as opposed to sending a drone over there and killing him and several other innocent people?
I kind of, every article that I've read about this, it's just assumed that it was impossible to arrest him. And I don't understand that.
Hmm.
Exactly. Why, if we can send soldiers all over the Middle East, why can't we arrest somebody in Yemen? Is it really that impossible?
We couldn't get it done in with Osama for quite a long time, and I think we all know why.
But they knew where this guy was. I mean, they knew exactly where he was. Osama was really hiding.
Well, but for example, let's say you were to assume that he's a soldier of an enemy force, but he happens to be a U.S. citizen. Could he be killed? I think the answer to that would be yes. If World War II, if
he's involved in belligerent acts at that time, yeah.
Sure, I would think so. But what Al Awlaki was doing was advocating. He was speaking. He didn't take up arms. Mm-hmm. He was advocating force and violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was an especially effective advocate, apparently.
Yes, he was.
Let me give you, by the way, again, the websites for the National Lawyers Guild, www.nlg.org, and for the international arm, www.nlginternational.org.
Another website where people can go if they want, there's a very good fact sheet that the Center for Constitutional Rights has put together on the NDAA, so you can get that on their website, which is
www.ccrjustice.org. Okay, ccrjustice.org. All right. Okay, Art, welcome to your legal rights.
Hi, I got a couple questions.
Sure.
How will this law be tested? And at the same time, the rights and life of a defendant in such a case be preserved? And what would you advise activists to do proactively to protect themselves from the effect of this law? Especially if you're an activist.
Okay, thank you, Art. I mean, these are incredible questions, really. Susan, your thoughts?
I think that everyone should continue their activism and, really keep track of everybody, make sure that people don't just sort of disappear. I'm actually more concerned with the Holder versus Humanitarian Law case in terms of relevance to, like, the Occupy activists and all of those, and most of the people that are our clients, that the material support provisions in the Patriot Act, I think, are really more of a threat to mm-hmm. people who are not engaged in mm-hmm. belligerent, mm-hmm. you know, activities against the U.S. So that's something also that I think people really should pay attention to and, you know, educate themselves about and try to do something about by just education. That's the best I think you can do.
Any other comments for Art?
In terms of protecting yourself, as much as possible, You know, I would try to keep things within the speech realm. You afforded quite a bit of protection by the First Amendment, so mm-hmm. I think it's certainly fine to write the editor of the newspaper, to contact your congressperson, to speak out, to write letters. But in terms of anything that involves money, I'd be very concerned about that.
What do you mean by that? Anything that involves money, what do you mean?
Well, I would be careful about making a donation.
A donation to any of these very questionable organizations?
I yeah. agree. I wouldn't make a donation. I mm-hmm. wouldn't even buy somebody a cup of coffee.
Wow.
Oh.
Wow.
To that extent. But I think to squarely keep things within the speech realm, I think you'd be safe.
All right. Let me take another call. Aaron, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
I have a terminology question, legal terminology. I'm reading a book called The Green is the New Red. It's about eco movement.
What's the name of it again?
Green is the New Red.
Green is the New Red. Okay.
Let's go over a bunch of different crimes that people committed in defending nature, but they don't go into great legal detail. My question is, the legal definition of terrorism, what is it? Is there such a thing called the crime of terrorism? I mean, these people are tried for arson, but all the terminology that the newspapers use, and even the president, the former president, is that they're eco-terrorists. So, does eco-terrorism have a legal definition? And if so, what is it? That's my question.
Well, let me get some comments for you. Thank you, Aaron, for your call. Any comments on this?
There is a law.
Eco-terrorism?
What is it? I'm not really familiar with this stuff, but
Stan, do you know anything about this?
Well, I mean, it was a little blurred, but I mean, for example, in California, there's something called making terrorist threats. Although the definition may have ended, I think the caller makes a very good point. Calling somebody a terrorist right. might be the equivalent of calling somebody a red or mm-hmm. In the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think it's dangerous because the term is not adequately defined. It gets back yeah. to the point that I had, that if people should be prosecuted for crimes, and if something is not adequately defined in the statute book, then he or she can challenge the constitutionality of it. But I don't think there's a sufficient definition of what a terrorist would be.
I think that this is one of the problems all over the country, not just all over the world, not just in this country. The use of the term terrorist is very easy, and it brings down a lot of grief on a lot of people.
Our number for Call the Lawyer is 1-800-525-9917. I want to thank you very much for joining us on the program. We have unfortunately come to the end of the program. Stan Friedman, certified specialist in criminal law, former chair of the Criminal Law Advisory Commission of the Board of Legal Specialization. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Eisenberg, appellate law certified specialist with offices in Oakland. And Susan Scott, co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild International Committee. Thank you very much for joining us. The program has gone on too fast, unfortunately, or gone over too fast. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Next week, we're going to be talking about financial planning for long-term care, Medicare, Medi-Cal, and private pay. My guests will be Peter Stern, a certified specialist in estate planning, and Timothy Millar, a financial planner. That's for next week. I hope you join us then. Thanks so much. And by the way, one further thing, if you want to get in touch with the Board of Legal Specialization for a specialist in your area, it's www.californiaspecialist.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Chuck Finney.